The podcast Campus Files is back with more stories of scandal, crime, and intrigue on college campuses.
It is not hard to destroy a college.
It's almost like a university under siege.
Listen to and follow Campus Files, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
It's 8:09 in the Twin Cities. Well, it has been another very busy week in the news cycle. One of the themes that has continued throughout the week is President Trump and his concern about news media coverage. It all sort of began, I think, this latest chapter with Trump tweeting out on Sunday morning a clip that he apparently had found on Reddit, or that originated on the social media site Reddit, that showed from an old clip of Trump's appearance on a WWE show of Trump wrestling what actually apparently was originally Vince McMahon back in 2007, but CNN was superimposed over his face, so it looked like the president was beating up CNN. Now there's a new video out there on social media that the president's son, Donald Trump Jr., has posted, with the president shooting out a jet from out of the sky with a CNN logo over superimposed over it. Meanwhile, CNN came back with a story in which they reveal sort of the source of this video without naming the source, and did it in a very unusual fashion, suggesting that they might reveal the source if the source continued to, put these kinds of things out there in public. Joining me right now is somebody who I have turned to for many years, but also especially in recent months, to try and sort through this heated back and forth between the president and the news media, is Jane Kirtley, Professor Jane Kirtley of the Silla Center at the University of Minnesota. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Esme.
All right. It just keeps getting a little crazier, doesn't it?
You know, it is beyond belief to me that we are engaging in this kind of back and forth at a time when I would think that there are crises that would command the president's attention. But, you know, he declared the media the enemy of the people. He has been on the warpath with CNN for quite some time, although I noticed a story in the Washington Post this morning pointed out that in the context of this continuing debate about what actually happened in the president's meeting with Vladimir Putin, he was actually pointing to CNN to support his story. So as somebody said, you know, if he agrees with it, it's great. And if he doesn't, it's fake news. And this is just another manifestation of that.
All right. There's been some, you know, even some discussion about whether or not Twitter actually has certain sort of bylaws or standards that it says it requires its users to adhere to. The problem with Twitter, though, is that they have been criticized for a very long time for not adhering to those. And, you know, these kinds of concerns extend to things, you know, far completely not involved with the president, concerns about, you know, terrorists using the site, bullies using the site. What are your and the president actually has defended his use of Twitter, saying it's not presidential, it's, quote, modern day presidential. A lot of discussion that this tweet involving the video with the CNN logo superimposed on it has gotten, I think, more retweets than any other. I mean, hundreds of thousands of retweets. What are your thoughts about that? And there are some who say, well, this is suggestive of violence towards the news media. Others say, no, that's ridiculous. It's obviously just a satire.
Well, you know, I am a big supporter of freedom of speech, and I always hesitate to start that way because when you follow that with a qualifier, it seems so hypocritical. My point here would be that I would accept the notion that this is satirical in the hands of the individual who originally created it. But the president chose, for whatever reason, to retweet it. So, you know, it belongs to him now. And I'm sorry, maybe he calls it modern presidential. I don't. To suggest that fighting the news media, wrestling it to the ground, is an appropriate thing for the president to do, especially given what happened with the congressman out in Montana doing the same thing to a reporter when he was running for office.
A congressman who was running for office in Montana who actually attacked a reporter and eventually apologized. That congressman was, in fact, though, the man who was running was, in fact, elected in a special election.
He was. And, you know, I think that sometimes people don't realize that these kinds of actions have ramifications way beyond the United States. In countries that are autocracies, like Russia, where journalists are frequently physically attacked and murdered, it's fine for President Trump to disagree with CNN. He can call them fake news if he chooses to. That doesn't bother me. But this kind of symbolic dismembering of the press, coupled with his incendiary commentary, I think it is distinctly unpresidential, and it bears no relationship to what I think the chief executive of this country should be doing.
Let's talk about CNN, because they've had some, it's separate from this, well, I suppose you can't really separate from this, but they've had some bumps here in the road. They had to basically retract a story that was a one source anonymous story, which is something that I didn't think people did anymore, about one of the president's supporters and advisors. And then they also had a problem with how they handled the reporting on this. Your thoughts about how CNN is kind of dealing with this?
Well, I think there are a couple of different issues here. The one source story that they had to retract, I mean, that's a journalistic sin as far as I'm concerned. You are really making yourself very vulnerable if you rely on a single source.
Anonymous source.
Anonymously, and well, even not anonymously, but certainly anonymously. And in this era where the media are so subject to criticism for manufacturing and fabricating things, it's just not a good idea to do it. And I will give CNN credit. They retracted, they corrected, which is more than many other so-called news sites will do. That doesn't excuse it, but I'm saying at least they owned up to it, which is not always the pattern these days. As far as they're dealing with the individual who allegedly created the original video, I think it's important to bear in mind that this individual is not a source of theirs. He is a news subject. And I think it was unfortunate that CNN basically said, we know who you are, we could report it, but we won't as long as you promise to be good in the future. I don't think that's the
role. I thought it was just bizarre.
It was bizarre. That's not the role of the media, to try to police people's future conduct. It's one thing to say, based on your past track record, we're not going to rely on you because we know you're a serial liar. That's one thing. Right. But to go forward and say, if you don't behave, we're going to do this. It's either newsworthy or it's not. It's either worth telling or it's not. It's either a legitimate matter of public interest that outweighs privacy and safety concerns, or it's not. I think CNN should own that and not play these kinds of games.
Right. And for those of you who may not understand the full story here, so I think most people have seen the video that the president tweeted out last Sunday. Well, it turns out that he didn't make that video. The origin of that video is that it was first made by somebody, this is what CNN reported, who was using Reddit, which is another form of social media that has these sort of message boards and people of like minds. It was a bunch of Trump supporters, and they put, one user made up this video and put it on Reddit. The president apparently retweeted it. CNN went, because I think it is newsworthy, did the president go through a little graphics program and make up this video? I think that would be of news interest.
A little story, yes,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, he didn't. This apparently came from Reddit. There's no denial from the White House on this. But the way CNN reported it, they said, well, this person who put together this video of Trump beating up the CNN, she has a history of anti-Semitic tweets or anti-Semitic posts on Reddit and other sort of, disparaging posts on Reddit. But they said, we're not going to name him. But if he behaves badly in the future, I mean, this isn't the exact wording, we will name him, which I thought it was the strangest thing. The only thing I could think of was that unless it was a minor, maybe, but there was no mention of that.
Well, there was actually, for a while, a story going around that it was a 15-year-old kid, and some of the alt-right sites, honed in on that and said, this is outrageous. The CNN would, as they put it, dox, that is, publish information about an anonymous poster. But the story now, apparently, is that this individual is not a minor. He's a guy that apparently lives in Tennessee. He's in his 40s. In any event, I mean, who knows? But I just keep going back to my original question, which is, did CNN think this was newsworthy? I think it was a newsworthy story to find out where this came from, and I can't imagine CNN was the only news organization that was trying to figure out who had done it. I think that's a legitimate story. But this gamesmanship of, if you behave the way we expect you to in the future, we won't reveal your name, and people are calling it extortion and blackmail, and that's ridiculous. That's not, it doesn't rise to that level, but I think it's not an appropriate thing for a news organization to do.
Right. And so anyway, but a lot of people did go on Twitter and call it just that. In terms of, you know, the continuing sort of showdown or stare down between the president and the news media, I mean, where do you see this headed? I mean, it just seems to continue to escalate.
Well, it not only escalates, it just gets more and more bizarre. I mean, and I'm sure everybody that's listening to this show knows that many presidents have had difficult relationships with the press. There is nothing new in that phenomenon. But President Trump seems to be uniquely unsuited to handling the press as the president of the United States it traditionally has. That is, you can have an adversarial relationship, you can certainly disagree, but there's a fundamental respect in the case of the press for the office and in the case of the president for the institution of the press. And I don't see that with President Trump. He genuinely seems to categorize the press as either, they're either on for him or they're against him, and if what they're reporting is something that doesn't go with his narrative, then they are clearly against him and that makes them fake news. And what is so disturbing to me, and I have to think it probably bothers you too, is that many of his supporters just eat this up and take it as a given that what he's saying is true and what the press is saying is false. Now, you know, Trump didn't invent the situation, but I think he is exploiting it in a masterful way.
You know, one of the ironies here, of course, is that the Hillary Clinton campaign was extremely critical, and others have been critical, too, of how the mainstream press, including the cable press, including CNN, basically gave President Trump a pass, or then candidate Trump a pass, and would just basically air a lot of his rallies unedited because they were so, you know, it was the showmanship was there, that factor, and that they were so unpredictable. And so they just thought, well, let's put the Trump rally on where they didn't put, you know, the Mark Rubio rally on. And certainly, you know, President or then candidate Trump's Republican opposition, the people running for the nomination who were running against him, objected to that, you know, loudly, as did Hillary Clinton when she was running against him. So it's amongst those who was doing it was CNN.
I agree. And I think that's a legitimate criticism. You know, I was in Europe the whole time up the run up to the election in 2016, and I was watching CNN International, which was not quite as obsessive in covering Trump as I think it was doing domestically. But absolutely, I mean, the man got tons and tons and tons of free and largely uncritical publicity. I think, you know, maybe he thought it was just going to keep on continuing like that. But I think it's a legitimate criticism to say that the press did not give all these candidates a fair shake. And, you know, now we're reaping the consequences of that with a president who just doesn't seem to understand that the role of the press is to oversee what the president is doing, not just be his public relations arm.
Right. And certainly, you know, I think your point about just about every single candidate, certainly every president, has been upset about the kinds of coverage they've gotten. Certainly, the Clinton campaign was livid for what they saw as the lack of reporting on the fact of Russian meddling in,
right,
you know, in the election, that got buried under the continued email situation and the email server situation, as well as the continued investigations with the Anthony Weiner link. And they felt that the mainstream press handed the election, or was one of the reasons that Donald Trump won, which
And let's not even talk about the Bernie Sanders campaign and his supporters and the feeling that he was completely marginalized and misrepresented. I mean, the point is, there's plenty for everybody to dislike in the way the election and, you know, the run-up to it was covered. And I'm not here to defend all of that coverage or to suggest that the balance was correct. But that's behind us now. And I think we need to be looking at what I see as a really serious situation, which is a president that seems to have contempt for the press the role of the press supports dictators and autocrats around the world who murder the press, and that his supporters seem to think that's just fine. I don't know what to say other than I think we are really in a crisis if the public as a whole does not think that the role of a free press is to keep an eye on what the president is up to, not just give him favorable publicity for whatever he's doing.
And in terms of that, it remains to be seen what can happen. And you know, your point about sort of Vladimir Putin, a friend of mine from high school's brother was the editor of Forbes Russia and was gunned down in the street when he was, he was in his late 30s.
Yeah,
assassinated.
These are not theoretical concerns. They are real, and they've been going on for a very long time, not just in Russia, but in other countries, too, that President Trump appears to embrace, the Philippines, Turkey. This is serious, and I think it has obviously symbolic importance because in other countries around the world where we have traditionally said, the president may not like the way the press covers him, but he supports the idea of a free press, I'm not sure we can say that at this moment, and I think we are ceding moral ground in this whole question about what's going to be the future of democratic structures around the world.
And you know, people who've been at rallies, and this is actually sort of nothing new, because I remember going back to like the Republican convention, I think it was like 1992, and Pat Buchanan, I think it was in Houston, kind of the press was all sort of in, obviously in sort of one group all together at the convention floor. And at one point, it was Buchanan who led, this chant at the news media. And this is, again, a long time ago, 1992, saying, tell the truth. And,
right.
And the reporters actually get called out. And I get it, we're tough, but you get called out. And certainly Trump does that at all of his rallies, both in the campaign, and he's continuing to do it right now. And I remember the rally that was held here just a couple of days before the election. There was somebody walking around with a large sign with a noose around it with CNN written on it. And there were taunts directed at the news media. I mean, we're big people, but, it was ugly. I mean, I felt fine, but I think that there were some other people, perhaps some younger reporters who felt a little intimidated, who had never been in that situation.
And it's absolutely true, and it is a tactic of those in totalitarian governments to try to marginalize and undermine the press. This is not a new phenomenon. It works very successfully, and you and I have discussed before that I think that there have been forces for a long time on both the left and the right that have tried to undermine public confidence in the press. I mean, it's fine to say the press doesn't always do things the way we would like to do, that they're not perfect, and that's fine. But to basically question the need for an independent voice to report critically on government, that is just to me incomprehensible, and I'm not sure where we're going with this.
All right. Doesn't look like it's going to stop anytime soon. Well, listen, Jane Kirtley, as always, thank you so much for your insights this evening.
It was a pleasure. Thank
Absolutely.
You.
All right. Yeah, it is fascinating stuff to see what happens, and it's interesting. I don't see this going away, though, and I think the president seems to draw energy off of it. I think CNN did make some mistakes with that story that they had to retract. I think, as Professor Kirtley pointed out, what they did in terms of the use of how they reported on this person who apparently put this video together, not the smoothest way to do it at all, but obviously some troubling dynamics here. And one can only see the next chapter. The next chapter may, in fact, be Donald Trump Jr., who has put on his Instagram tonight a image or a video that shows Trump shooting down a plane. Obviously, it's a fake video of a shoot down a plane that's labeled CNN. The latest, what can I say? All right, folks. It is 8:28 in the Twin Cities. We do have to take a break. We'll give you some weather. I do want to let you know that normally at this hour we do chat with Professor David Schultz. He is actually in Beijing for 2 weeks. He's teaching there at a university there, and I can't wait to talk to him when he gets back. So that is where Professor Schultz is, which is, I think it's about a 14-hour time difference, so I guess it's the middle of the day there, I think. I think they're ahead of us. I'll check into that. But anyway, let's take a quick break. We'll give you some weather. And then when we come back, there's a big birthday going on right now in Minnesota. Spam, 80 years old. We'll tell you what that means. We'll celebrate after this break, after weather, here on News Radio 830 WCCO.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
It is 8:34 in the Twin Cities. Esme Murphy with you, along with Kevin Reed, until 9 o'clock. Well, guess what? It is Spam's 80th birthday, not the email kind. Yes, Spam. That is now a staple in 44 countries that is credited with helping get our fabulous World War II vets through the war. Certainly enormously popular in places like Hawaii. Certainly the UK continues to be popular. And of course, right here in the good old US of A. Joining me right now is Brian Lillis. He is the Spam brand manager. Brian, have I said your name correctly? And do I have your title right?
You do. That is correct.
Okay. All right. Let me ask you, first of all, are there any sort of special festivities going on for Spam's 80th birthday? I know that you've got the Spam Museum in Austin.
We do have a new building that we are in downtown Austin that we just opened up last year. And actually, last night, to celebrate the 80th birthday, we did have a big block party right out in front of the museum in downtown Austin last night. So we did have a birthday celebration with a big birthday cake set up outside as well.
All right. Let me ask you, how did Spam get its start?
Well, Spam was started back in 80 years ago, 1937. It was, you know, one of the first convenient, moderately priced, and really great tasting meat products on the market. It was started, and as you even mentioned as well, where it really got a lot of the rise and its usage was through World War II, and we'd send it to a lot of the troops overseas and the Allied forces, and it just took off from there, and people continued to use it. They brought it back home with them and found new and exciting ways to use it as well.
All right. So it was one, and when you think about it, folks, I mean, there just weren't sort of the canned foods, just were not anywhere near as prevalent. And this was one of the first, and it was invented, I assume, right here in Minnesota.
That is correct. Yep, right here in Austin, Minnesota. The president at the time of the Hormel Foods company was looking for a way to put meat into a can, came up with this iconic shape that we have in the square can, and it took off from there, and it's grown ever since.
All right. And what was the role that you know of in World War II?
So as the U.S. entered World War II, Spam played a crucial role overseas. With our Allied forces that were fighting in Europe, Hormel provided 15 million cans of food to troops each week. And so it immediately became a constant part of the soldiers' diets, and it earned a lot of praise, if you will, for feeding starving British and Soviet armies as well as the civilians. So it continues to enjoy success today because the promise of the Spam brand is the same as it was at its start back in 1937, versatile, affordable protein that provides a way for a convenient way for a family to spice up their meals.
All right. And what are some of the areas, because apparently it's available in 44 countries. Are there some markets that are bigger than, you know, are big ones for Spam?
Yes. Continuing towards the Hawaii direction, if you will, the Asia Pacific region definitely sees a huge usage of Spam over there. The UK is obviously big as well, but in that Asia Pacific, Japan, the Philippines, Korea, it's really big in Korea. It's given almost as a gift, if you will, a prized possession over in that country too.
Really? Okay. I know if you go to Hawaii and you go to like a convenience store and you know how here they'll sell the hot dogs at the convenience store, they'll have, I think it's called Spam Musubi. It's like a Spam sushi, which instead
That's
of the
correct.
Fish, you've got Spam there, and it's got the rice, the sushi rice and the seaweed. And that's considered a snack and everybody eats it. It's enormously popular. And is that just sort of a vestige of World War II as well?
It is, yeah, as a lot of the GIs went across and then came back from the Asia-Pacific area, and some of them settled in, and it became part of their normal day-to-day eating, and it took hold in the Hawaiian Islands, and they've continued to find new and interesting ways. And as you talked about Spam Musubi as kind of the it's almost as infamous as a slice of pizza in New York or a hot dog in Chicago out there. You can find it at the convenience stores all over the place.
All right. And so then when did Spam sort of kind of branch out into different, like, have there always been so many flavors of Spam? I mean,
No, there haven't. Our classic, the original Spam, is still the number one, if you will, and the number one variety that people take and eat. But, you know, our flavoring, our slight variations on that with our lower sodium and our less fat, those types of items are still are popular as well. But then we started to get into some more regional flavors. Bacon has become a very popular one, just given the sheer rise in popularity of bacon as well. We have a Spam teriyaki, a Spam chorizo. So definitely some different flavors that we've been able to embed. I wouldn't say that they're as great as the original, as the classic, but they definitely find their niche with a lot of our consumers.
All right. And in terms of, you know, here in the U.S., you know, a lot of people kind of crack jokes about Spam, but does it remain popular here in the U.S.?
It definitely does. I think one of the things that we've seen over the last few years, especially, is the sheer number of, you know, as we've gotten a lot of this Hawaiian influence into our restaurants and that type of thing, these chefs that are putting Spam into their menu options and creating new and exciting different recipe ideas, and that's really helped to take hold. You know, we've gotten a large number of news articles written about us that Bon Appetit Online, which you wouldn't normally think of as talking about Spam, has even done articles about us. Just
really?
Highlighting the
and what did they have to say?
You know, they highlighted a few different recipes and the way that you can be, it can be so versatile and convenient for making these different recipes and add some different flavoring to those recipes as well.
All right, so Bon Appetit has written you up as well, but you're saying the basic Spam is the one that continues to drive the engine there.
That's correct. That's the one that so many people, you know, over 110 million cans a year that are being consumed in the United States. So
110 million in the U.S. alone?
Over the course of the 80 years, we've produced and sold over 8 billion cans of Spam. And we're well on our way towards 9 billion cans as well.
All right. You know something? I have been past the Spam Museum, but I have never gone inside, I'm sorry to say. What do you see in the Spam Museum and this additional building that you've got?
Well, and it's a great location in downtown Austin there, right on Main Street, now that we've got it downtown. We've got a large number of displays that talk all about the history, not just the history of the Spam brand, but history of Hormel and how that came to be, and then how the impetus for creating Spam is a part of it as well. Over 14,000 square feet, all about this square meat that we've got there in Austin, Minnesota.
And what are some of the exhibits there?
Yeah, we've got one that talks about what we call the Can Central. So it's kind of the heart of the museum, and it showcases and highlights the different marketing and campaigns that we've done, but also the people's love for that iconic shape of the can itself. We've got, as I mentioned, history, 1891 and beyond, so it talks about the history of the Hormel Foods Corporation. We've got a whole area about supporting our troops, which is really kind of what I alluded to earlier about the work that we did during World War II and how it helped our troops during the war. Basic information about the Spam brand. We've got an area where kids can come in and play, which during the Minnesota winters is a great place to have. And then, you know, talking about Hormel Foods today, just all the different brands that make up Hormel Foods as well.
Right. Oh, and what percentage of roughly, do you have any idea, did Spam remain of Hormel Foods? Because obviously Hormel is, you know, you guys have so many products now.
We do. It's still a large part of the overall portfolio of products, one of the great brands that Hormel has, 80 years strong and continuing to rise in popularity and usage across the country and around the world.
Right, and you also have all these, I'm on your website here, you actually have, do people really buy all these Spam products? I mean, everything from hockey jerseys to umbrellas to T-shirts.
Yeah. The Spam fans are amazing. They love our brand and they love to showcase our brand and find ways to wear our merchandise. And yes, if you come down to Austin, we have it. Not only do we have the merchandise online, we actually have a shop connected right there with the museum, so you can come down and try the apparel on so you can wear it out the door.
You've got the Spam boxer shorts and everything. I mean, why is it that I mean, you have other products as well. You've got luncheon meats. I think you've got mashed potatoes. I mean, you've got all kinds of things. What is it about this particular item? I mean, you have a whole museum dedicated to this particular item. What is it about this particular item?
We do, and I think a lot of it harkens back to this nostalgia as well. So many of our consumers grew up on the product, and then they're in turn taking it and sharing it with their family and showcasing it in their different meal items and that type of thing. So the idea that you can see that can and know, yes, I can remember what that smell was like when it was in the griddle and when it was sizzling in the pan, and know what I could expect then when I bit into it. And that's what I want to be able to share and showcase my love for the brand as well.
Okay. And actually, we have a question from a listener. Should we put the listener on here? Oh, okay. Well, the question from the listener is this. This is a really good question. How did Spam get its name?
That is a great question, and that's one that everybody likes to ask. There's some history there in terms of, on New Year's Eve back in 1936, Jay Hormel, who was president of the company at the time, hosted a party and asked his different guests to submit their most creative name for his new luncheon meat. And an actor from New York named Kenneth Dagano was the lucky one to win $100 for his suggestion of the name Spam. Now, there's some speculation on where he came up with the name. Some say it was inspired by taking the first two letters of spice and the last two letters of ham and combining it to call Spam, but this has never actually been confirmed.
Okay, so it was an actor and it was a contest for $100, and $100 back in,
1936, New Year's Eve, 1936.
Okay,
about a year before he rolled off. Yeah,
and still in the middle of the Depression.
Yeah,
that's a fair amount of money.
Okay. Yes, and it's part of the uniqueness of the brand as well, and that there's a little bit of uniqueness to the name and how it was created as well.
And how, I mean, because so this is only 1936. I mean, how do you have any idea how they quickly grew so quickly or got into the military contracts? Because, I mean, that's not a lot of time.
No, it wasn't. I think that there were...
I mean, and this is a different age with, you know, not the kind of automation you've got now. I mean, how did they get so big so quickly in terms of supplying, the Allied Army?
You know, the company itself, Hormel Foods, has been around for 125 years, so... Only having Spam around for 80 of those years, they were definitely in tune with innovating and finding new ways to create processes to be able to ramp this up. And the creation of the Spam lines and being able to create the Spam brand was no exception. You'll have to come down to the museum to go through the World War II area and find out more about how the troops felt about Spam. I think most of them would say, even Eisenhower himself would say, thank you, it definitely helped us, but I think we're full now on our Spam. So it was a way that...
but I mean, it's remarkable that so quickly they were able to get this product out. And was it all manufactured in Austin?
At the time, yes. We now have three different manufacturing facilities, one in Austin, one down in Fremont, Nebraska, and one in Dubuque, Iowa. But at the time, yes, it was primarily made in Austin, Minnesota.
All right. I mean, just to be able to launch it on really sort of a global basis back then is really a remarkable feat by the Hormel company as well. One of the things that you have on your website, you have information about the varieties and everything like that, but you also have a lot of recipes. I mean, do you have any idea how often people are accessing these recipes and looking at them?
You know, it's pretty regularly. I will say that in this day and age, the idea of searching for recipes online, finding recipes online as to what to make for dinner that evening, that's definitely why we've got a large number of recipes that are out there. I would say too, we've been able to tie that in at the museum. I know that there are kiosks there where you can email yourself different Spam recipes right from the museum as well. And we've had, over the course of the first year that we've been open downtown, over 100,000 people have come into the museum, and I think we've had in the tens of thousands of email recipes that have been emailed out. So we definitely know that people are looking for ways, unique ways, to be able to enjoy this product as well.
Buzz, that's so interesting. Yeah, and also the Star Tribune had, and your recipes actually, I think, are just the ones I'm looking at are pretty modern ones that I think would appeal to a family with, like, you know, noodles and tacos, right, and things that you could use, you know, pretty traditionally. I don't know if you saw the Star Tribune with their retro recipes. And a big spread on that, which was, you know, recipes that obviously were from another era.
Another era, yes. It was a unique article to talk about all the different ways and see how the usage of the Spam brand has continued to change through the course of time as well. So, yes, it's definitely something that, you know, even the Spam musubi recipe that we have out there is a way to showcase, and how to use it is another fun one. We tend to use it a lot with kids, and because it's a fun one that they can put together and put their own touch to it as well.
All right. And if you go down to the library or the museum, sorry, in Austin, can you buy some Spam?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. We have all 15 varieties that are available there, along with those boxer shorts that you'd like to be able to purchase and put on and wear out of there as well.
Yeah. I mean, and how many different items do you have with the Spam logo on them?
Oh, I don't even know what our count is right now. We've got a wide variety that are available both in the physical shop as well as online too.
Okay. And when is the Spam Museum open down there?
Spam Museum is open 7 days a week, so we're open most days. And I think all the way until, if I bring my hours up here correctly, right now in the summer months, we're usually open until about 6 p.m., only open for certain hours on Sunday, but you can come down and most days and we'll be open.
All right.
And to have you.
And check out the website. Well, listen, we certainly appreciate Brian Lillis, Spam Brand Manager. And have you been the Spam Brand Manager for a long time?
No, not. If a year is a long time on this brand, then I would say yes. I've been with the company a longer time than that, though.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for talking all things Spam with us this evening.
You bet. Thank you very much.
All right, folks. All things Spam. Well, we got some time here. Maybe you have your own Spam recipe. I'll go over. You can give us a call, 651-989-9226, 1-866-989-9226. Do you have a Spam recipe or a Spam story? 651-989-9226, 866-989-9226. And I will actually pull up my text. Do we have a call here, Brian? Oh, no. Or Kevin, sorry. Okay. I'm sorry that he was signaling that we did have a call here. Just wondering if you had any particular recipes that you'd like. I'm going to read some of the recipes.
Perfect.
All right. This is from the Star Tribune, which I think did a nice job. The Spam Upside Down Pie. These are their retro throwback glorious recipes for Spam. It is a Spam Upside Down Pie. The next one is Spam Birds. And it's just wrap a slice of Spam around some stuffing, fastened with a toothpick, brown in the oven, and somehow this is a bird. I'm serious. This is a real recipe. Spam and macaroni loaf. Spam Fiesta peach cups.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
yeah. I'm not
Moses.
A big meat and fruit guy, so that's probably
Spam, and I'm
me.
Sure it's like the peach cups. Remember the peach cups with the heavy syrup?
Ugh, oh, is it peach and nut pineapple? Because I know ham and pineapple is a big thing, but it's peach and not pineapple.
It's peach.
Okay.
I get, well, like ham and
yeah,
the pizza.
Yeah, my wife's big on that. That's not one of mine, but yeah.
The Spam and pineapple or the ham and pineapple?
The ham and pineapple.
That is really good on a pizza. I am with your wife, absolutely, all the way. But apparently, these are the throwback recipes, all right. Spam Fiesta peach cups. Spam and banana fritters.
Mm.
Try luscious fried bananas with sliced Spam. Spam and cheese ribbon loaf. Tender pure Spam joins with zesty cream cheese mixture for the memorable eating. Well, I can see. Okay. It's like ham and
gotcha.
Cream cheese. I gotcha. Spam and limas. You know, lima beans are probably my least favorite food in the universe because spam and a Spanish sauce of canned tomatoes, onions, peppers, celery leaves, sugar, salt, and lard will help lima beans become edible.
Bacon
there you
fat
go.
Right okay. there. Okay. So everything's good with bacon fat.
Planked spam. Okay, score a whole spam and rub with brown sugar, kind of like I'm thinking ham here, surrounded on the plank, like a plank of wood, with tomato slices capped with large mushrooms doused in butter. Butter makes everything taste better. Bake 25 minutes in hot oven, then ring with mashed potatoes and slip back into the oven for quick browning. Bring to the table, plank and all, and be greeted with cheers.
Yeah, that's
good.
That sounds like a low-fat recipe to me.
Spam Brittany. Okay, bake spam with marmalade and apples. This sounds very Brit. Sounds good to me. Spam, apples, orange marmalade, and whole cloves all baked together. So easy, of course. A baked bean spamwich. Husband's home for lunch. This is from an old advertising thing. Pamper him like this. With this messy sandwich that will drop sticky baked beans all over his lap. Oh, and don't forget to serve your sexist sandwich with this equally sexist side of a man-style salad of canned peaches and cottage cheese.
Well, I could do without the canned peaches and cottage cheese.
You know something? I remember the canned peaches.
Oh, well,
and
I do.
Cheese.
Oh, I do. I'm not that young. I remember them well. Okay. My dad loved that stuff, but no.
Okay. Bonus, not a recipe, but still super odd. This is all according to the Star Tribune and their throwback. Spam recipes. Spam spokes couple Gracie Allen and George Burns did a lot for the canned meat, including this skit. Gracie, if a strange man offered to buy you a lunch, what would you say? Burns asked. No, the answer isn't get away from me, weirdo. You weirdo. Allen replies, spam. Okay.
Yeah,
I give up.
And on that note... But yeah, the spam and baked bean sandwich, I could go for that. The peach and cottage cheese is not my thing.
I could see in scrambled eggs or something like that.
Scrambled eggs, in an omelet. You know, instead of ham in an omelet, you could use spam
Know,
with the vegetables and the Denver omelet.
Right.
I guess that would be an Austin omelet then, maybe?
An Austin omelet, exactly. And some of the recipes with, I said, the tacos and, you know, if you're hard-pressed to kind of make something for kids or the pasta, I think it just... Fine. I wasn't aware that there were that many different types of spam, but I've learned a lot more about spam than I knew before.
Mm-hmm.
So edifying here. No pun intended. All right, folks. I do want to give a shout out to the producer of this show, Susan Blanche. I know this was kind of a hard week to put together with that 4th of July holiday in the middle of the week. But as always, a great show, and she's been doing such a great job with Jordana and all the people filling in on the afternoon show. So I want to give a shout out to Susan, and also a big shout out as well to the spam recipe guy, Kevin. Thank you. And also Kevin Reed, and also to Jonathan Lowe. So keep it right here, folks. You are listening to News Radio 830 WCCO right now in the Twin Cities. It is 8:57 and 80 degrees.
Hey y'all, Poodle and Maddie here from Reality Gaze.
Grab your favorite thong because for the first time, we're heading to the villa for the new season of Love Island USA.
I can't wait to watch Ariana babysit these shiny, oiled up adults who I'm pretty sure aren't there for the right reasons.
From the home-wrecking bombshells to the absolute wreckage of movie night.
Pull up a daybed and join us every Wednesday for all the Love Island USA drama.
Find Reality Gaze wherever you get your podcasts.